Indeed it is, with our guest Gershon Winkler, his works Magic of the Ordinary, Daily Kabbalah, and we're going to be back with him. Let's talk a little bit about death and dying on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Gershon Winkler. Gershon, how does tradition look at death and dying?
That's a pretty nice thing to do every once in a while. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like in the Zohar, going back to the Kabbalah, the way the Zohar translates that famous verse, and God saw everything that God had made, and behold, it was very good. The Zohar says, this refers to death. Ain't that cute? Because that's what death is. Death is birth. See, we died and were reborn a lot of times. For example, I died in the spirit world, and my death resulted in my being born into the womb world. Then I died in the womb world, and then I was born into this world. And one day I will die in this world, and I will be born into some other world. I don't know what, but I'll find out when I get there.
So you believe in reincarnation?
Yeah, it's very much a part of it. I mean, we are constantly being reincarnated. We go from world to world. It is endless. It is infinite. It is beautiful. It's wonderful. It's exciting. It's not that we need to look forward to death as a wonderful thing to happen. It'll happen in its due time. It is more important, we are taught in our tradition, to focus on here and now life and to make of our lives the best that we can and imbue it with the highest quality of appreciation and awareness of the gift of being alive in this world. And at the same time, we're taught that we should not fear the inevitable, that there is, just like the American Express card, there is an expiration date. And one day we each have that date and we're going to leave this world. It doesn't mean that we're not going to be anywhere else, just like it didn't mean that when we left the spirit world and went into the womb world and left the womb world and came into this world.
I prefer an expiration date, though, that's way out there.
Me too. I like it here. It's really nice. You know, there's a cute midrash. Midrash is like the oral tradition where the ancient teachers would have fun discussing philosophy in a humorous way. And so they describe the soul about to come into the body and protesting to the angel that's about to escort this new soul into a fetus. It says, what are you doing? I like it here. I like being in the light. I like being in the godly world with all these angels singing all this Tchaikovsky stuff. I want to be here. And the angel keeps dragging and dragging until the soul, kicking and screaming and protesting, ends up in the womb. And there it says, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. I don't want to be here. I don't want to. Oh, this is nice. You know, it's like 2001 Space Odyssey. I mean, later we're going to pay thousands of dollars for a sensory deprivation tank. And here it's for free. We're just floating around in this beautiful darkness. And
not a care in the world.
That's right. Not a care in the world. And you know, we don't have to eat. The food's coming in with cream, ice cream. And even a health food mother is sneaking out to 7-Eleven to get a Hershey bar. And you're getting really good stuff, and this is a really great place. I like it here. You lean back, and you relax, and you make yourself at home in the womb until that angel comes back again after the ninth month and says, well, time for you to leave this world now and go into the next world. And you say, no, I was just kidding about protesting the other time. I'm really sorry I gave you such a hard time. You know, I really like it here. This is really my place. I think I'll stay. And again, protesting and against our will, we are forced out of that beautiful, relaxing, comfortable, cozy womb world into this world. And that's why we're screaming when we come out, I don't want to be here. 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 Then we like it. Oh, there's cable here. And there's a pizza and sex. And I mean, not right away, the pizza, that is. And, you know, so you kind of begin to get used to this world. And this becomes the one you want to stay in and you don't want to ever leave. See, so it's like a really funny way in which the human being protests leaving each of the worlds that he or she comes out of, and then eventually finds that the world that they go into next is even more fun than the one that they just left.
Why reincarnation?
Why reincarnation? Because in at least in our tradition, reincarnation is if you put it this way, the Creator likes peace and quiet in the heavens. And so if I don't live my life to as full as I can and really enjoying the gifts of, and blessings that come to my life, then when I die, when my soul leaves my body, my soul will be so vividly aware, being away from the subjection of limitation that my body subjected it to, it'll be so aware of all the things that I should have, could have. Oh, I wish I would. Oh, man, I wish I could. Oh, I should have answered that email. Oh, I wish it. Oh, man. And God doesn't like complainers. So your ass is sent right back again. And so, like, if I didn't spend enough time here in this world at least once eating a good potato knish, I'm going to have to come back here in another lifetime, born into a family that owns a deli, because all the gifts of life are there for the soul to really partake of, in order for the soul to grow to its maximum, to its optimal potential. And so if I just go through life studying and reading and being very serious and not really enjoying myself a lot, not really eating good stuff that tastes good, and having a little fun in my life, then my soul will feel very, very, very unfulfilled once it leaves my body, to the point that it really wants to come back again and have another opportunity and another opportunity, as much as it takes for it to reach its optimal sense of yum, satisfaction.
Yet in all of this, there's good, there's bad. Tell me about evil. Why are there demons, for example? Possessions.
First of all, you know, demons have been very badly demonized by the media and by some of some religions. In the Judaic concept around demons, there are good demons and there are bad demons. They have their own life, their own universe, and just like there are good people and there are bad people, there are good spirits and there are bad spirits. The problem is that when a mortal, when a human being dabbles in some of the parts of the occult that they shouldn't be dabbling in. In other words, opening up portals that to other universes where we really shouldn't be interfering, it opens up the opportunity for these other beings that live in this other dimension to come into our dimension and wreak havoc. And that's when it becomes a bad thing. But otherwise, you know, if we leave them alone and stop dabbling with those portals, they have their own life and their own problems to deal with, their own joys, and they don't need us, and we certainly don't need them. And it's sad that there are times when people do dabble a little bit too much in when they're not really ready for it, and then not only do they open up the portals for these spirits to, on their whim, just come into our world, but they also might even come and take over that person and possess them, and then they have to have an exorcism. But most of the possessions, at least in our tradition, are not about demonic possession, and more about the possession by a soul that used to be in a living human being, but who has trouble in making their transition after death to the other world, to the world of spirit, to the world of souls. And so that soul, that disembodied soul, then wanders the world looking for a potential candidate, someone very vulnerable, whose own soul is not really at the helm, in which to take over this person so that they could maneuver this person in order to accomplish what they feel is not fully resolved. And so therefore the exorcism that a rabbi would then do would be a healing ritual for both the victim, for being so vulnerable and not at the helm, and for the soul that's having trouble making its transition. So there are so many different kinds of possession and exorcism. There's also the what we call the sota ibor, which is mystery impregnation, which is the possession that takes over a person. The person's taken over, that is, by the soul of another person who has died a long time ago, but who mastered what this individual who is now living is unable to do. This person is really trying hard to make a transformation in their life, but they just can't get over the fence. And so there are times when a soul of someone who has had the same problem, the same obstacles, and who did succeed in climbing over the fence would then come and take over this person in order to support them and to help them. For that, there's no exorcism. When the person has been pushed over the fence and gotten their life together, thanks to the help of this spirit guide, then the spirit guide leaves on its own accord. It is sort of like a spirit guide, but it's a spirit guide that actually moves into the person's persona, into the person's body to help them get over their obstacle. So there's so many different varieties and situations that we have concerning possession and exorcism. It's not just about demonic, and it's not all evil all the time.
How does the person get possessed?
What happens is that the soul and our soul is so manifested in us, so integrated within us that we don't know where it is, because it's in our pinky, it's at our body, it's in our liver, in our kidney, our brain, it's everywhere. It's all of who we are, mm-hmm. all of us. Just like that song, "All of Me, I Wanna Be All of Me," right? So that's the soul singing throughout our body.
Stick to being a rabbi.
Right.
don't quit your day job.
This is why I'm not a congregational rabbi. So if there is a person who is in a catatonic state, for example, a state where their soul is not really fully manifested in them, it's kind of, they're in limbo in land, they're living in the twilight zone. In such a situation, they are very vulnerable if there is present in nearby proximity a wandering soul or spirit looking for a body to manipulate toward its particular personal end.
Okay, so if they find you, whether you're weak or you're, let's say you're drunk, you're drinking, I've heard stories that people tend to get possessed when they're in that kind of environment or situation.
I never thought of that. That's quite possible, yeah.
How do you get rid of them?
Well, then you have to do a ceremony. Then you have to bring in the language of the spirit world. That's the exorcist. So you call in the rabbi exorcist, and the rabbi exorcist Kabbalist knows the particular incantations to chant. Incantation means a certain language that is of the spirit realm. It's a spirit language. It's not like Hebrew or Aramaic all the time. It's a language without, it's words without language, a language without words. And these incantations are specifically designed by the ancients for us to use in such situations because they have the power within their pronunciation to, like, abracadabra. Abracadabra is like Hebraic, Aramaic for "I create what I speak." So these incantations create energies that begin to summon that the invading spirit or soul to come to the forefront and have to respond to the prayers that would then follow that would make it impossible or uncomfortable for the spirit to remain in the body of the victim. And it, the incantation incorporates both a summoning and a healing, so that whatever needs to be healed in this wandering soul can be healed at the same time, so that when it leaves, it will be able to make its transition complete into the realm of souls and never come back again.
How would you categorize ghosts in various situations like hauntings?
Yeah, see, hauntings, there are different categories of that. I would say, for example, when in the ancient times, when we go to a war or something, we would capture vessels, pots and pans or something from the enemy, mm-hmm. and we would take it home, but we could not use it until we purged it through fire. Why? Because there's the understanding that when someone creates something, a work of art, a vessel, something of pottery, whatever it might be, they are investing an aspect of their soul into that inanimate object. So likewise, when people live in a home long enough, for example, and they create it, and they build a house, and they build the shelves, they build the furniture, whatever it might be. They have invested, imbued what they have created with some aspect, sparks of their soul, then lives in what they have created. Sparks of the soul of the sculptor lives in his or her sculpture. Sparks of the soul of the artist lives in his or her painting, in the original, that is, not in the prints. And so when we move into somebody's house and certain very traumatic events happen there, you know, so there are investments of soul energy that still lingers, even though the person is dead and long gone and even made its transition complete. There still remains aspects of that individual or what happened that remains embodied in spirit energy that has a life of its own. Just like if you take two candles and one candle is lit, one is not. When you light the second candle, the second candle has all of the elements of the first and is just as hot without taking away from any of the energy or the heat of the first. And that's how soul stuff works. It's not like something you understand in a linear way. It's a whole different language. So we invest things or places with our presence. When we abandon a place, for example, the Talmud talks about this, the ancient rabbinic teachings, when we abandon a place that we have invested ourselves, our creativity in, it becomes an abode for demonic energies because demonic energies are attracted to anything of spirit because that's
like,
their
like
realm.
A magnet, isn't it?
Like a magnet, because there's a vacuum now that you created in leaving this place and abandoning this place. We created a vacuum so that there are aspects of our spirit energies that are still lingering, and that draws other entities of spirit realms because the portal door is wide open. It's been left open.
Are they trying to get our attention with hauntings, for example?
Yeah, they are. They're trying to get our. They're trying to tell people don't go into a ruin in the nighttime.
Yeah.
So some rabbis said it's because it's dangerous. Something might fall on your head. And other rabbis say, no, there's much deeper reason for that, which is telling you that because you might not believe the other reason, which is that it has become a vacuum, empty of mortal space, thereby filled possibly by demonic space, by spirit space, of spirits that might be not so good all the time. And so they're trying to talk about hauntings. They're trying to give you an understanding of what a haunting is and how we create hauntings. It's not something that comes to us and forces its way into our lives. It's something that happens by our investment of our creative self, of sparks of our soul that we leave in a place, in a negative way perhaps, which then draws something through the portals that does not belong here. And in dealing with hauntings, what we usually do is not try to drive the spirit out, to drive the ghost out of the house, because cold turkey is not a very healthy thing to do because it sometimes makes things worse. What we do is we assign to the spirit a little corner in the house and say, okay, you got something to work out here and something to finish. So this is your corner. 30 days, this is your place. After
Hold on,
days,
we're coming back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Gershon Winkler with us. We'll get into some of the other things of hauntings and ghosts when we come right back. Well, next hour we'll take your phone calls with Gershon Winkler as we talk about these incredible mystic moments. And we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with Gershon Winkler, his book, Magic of the Ordinary and Daily Kabbalah. In the book, Magic of the Ordinary, we talk about recovering the shamanic in Judaism. Explain that for us, Gershon.
Oh, yeah.
Now we're getting into the good stuff.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, it's so amazing how Judaism has been so least explored anthropologically. It's like been written out of anthropology. But, you know, there is a reason for it. I don't want to go into it in public. But, you know, there The early explorers who came from Europe and came to the Americas, where they encountered the so-called savages, you know, the Native Americans that they call savages, they wrote back in their chronicles. These are early explorers from Holland, from England, Spain. All of them back then wrote back in their chronicles how uncannily similar were the ways and practices and customs of the savages and the ways and customs of the Jews. And, you know, to the Jewish people, this was not unheard of. We were very like, wow, this is great. As one rabbi wrote in the 16th century, Rabbi Menashe ben Israel, he says, wow, this is wonderful. It shows how the more ancient you go in traditions and philosophies and religions, the more people had in common, because at some point we were all one little clan with one common conceptualization of Genesis, of creation, of how we got here and what life is all about, and great spirit, whatever you want to call the great mystery that created this world. And so we have in our tradition, this just like these early explorers found out, all of this great stuff of mystery, wisdom, of journeying into the underworlds, of teachings about the spirits of grasses and the spirits of trees. Ein kol esav esav shein baruch hamamuna alav. You know, the Talmud says, there's not a single blade of grass that doesn't have a spirit that encourages it to grow. When a bird flies over you, its wings are slicing through the ether to open up the shoots of divine flow. I mean, there, you know, like in the book of Job, it says, you know, ask the earth and she shall tell you, speak to the fish and they shall guide you, to the animals of the field, they shall teach you. This is all very much a part of our tradition. In Rabbi Miriam Maron's book that's coming out next month, Moon Wisdom, she talks about the totems that our tradition had of all the animals, of all the tribes. We had 12 tribes in ancient Israel, and each tribe corresponded to a totem, a snake for the tribe of Dan, a lion for the tribe of Judah, a wolf for the tribe of Benjamin, a gazelle for the tribe of Naphtali, and so on and so forth, the oryx for the tribe
of... Where did these tribes go, by the way?
Where'd they go?
They're gone, aren't they?
Well, yeah, well, some of them went to Target, and the others, I don't know where they went. You know, ten of them were displaced by Sanharib back in 2,600 years ago by the Assyrian invaders of the northern part of Israel. And so they were displaced. And so in modern times, we were able to locate sects of Jews in India, in Ethiopia, in Siberia, you know, And so we, little by little, we have found some remnants of these tribes carrying the names in their peoplehood of the tribal names of the tribe they corresponded to. So little by little, we have found a few remnants of a few of them, but they were very severely displaced, which is how the Babylonians would conquer a country. They would displace the people and replace the country with other people, really mix everything up to really destroy it. So there is an oral tradition in our people that goes like this, that the 10 lost tribes ended up in a deep, dark Congo, some place in deep, dark, inaccessible part of Africa, where they are led by a woman who is the granddaughter of the patriarch Jacob and who lives forever, and she's their queen.
And they're there now somewhere hidden
away? And they're somewhere right now, and nobody knows where it is. And no one knows how to get there, and some ancient rabbis tried to get there, and they were unsuccessful and never came back to talk about it. So it's a very foreboding kind of place where they continue to live and are ruled by the queen, whose name is Serach, not Sarah, but Serach, who was the granddaughter of Jacob. And she was given the blessing of living forever. Because when she came, she was asked by the brothers of Joseph, after they found out he was still alive in Egypt, if you saw the movie. So she was asked by the brothers to sing and storytell and dance the news to their old father so he would get it gently. And she did that, and he didn't believe her, Jacob didn't, and he said, Joseph is still alive, like you're going to live forever. And so she did. She lives forever, and she's the queen of the 10 lost tribes in a deep, 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 foreboding place in deep, dark Africa where nobody can go.
Do you think they kept up with technology?
Hey, you never know. I have a feeling that, my sense of it is that they didn't, that they're living very primitively. That's very just primitive. My sense, yeah. It's just my sense. I mean, my sense, I don't know. I mean, my sense is not always the most clear sense in the world. But that's the feeling I always get whenever I talk about it, whenever I think about it. There's a river that one has to find in order to explore where they live. And that river is given a name in the Midrash. It's called the River of Sambation. Sambation.
So where might that be?
Yeah, well, that's the thing.
We don't know, huh? You would think in this era of satellite photographs, they'd spot them. So. Who knows?
Who knows? Maybe it's in an underworld. Who knows? We have no idea. We have to do some exploration. So, George, I want you to find a very rich person to give me a big grant, and I'll go explore.
I have a feeling you could write your own check.
I wish.
tell me about what do your colleagues say about your views, Gershon? I mean, For a traditionalist, you're different. I mean, you believe in life and outer space. You believe in the possibility of extraterrestrials. I mean,
yes,
I do. You believe in ghosts and demons. And I mean, that's different than most, I think.
Yes. I mean, the mainstream really hasn't touched these ancient writings and teachings. And that's sad because many Jewish people, for example, are hungry for something beyond the box. They have a sense that there's something more to life than what life is defined as for them in their culture. And so they go looking for it. They visit shamans in Peru. They visit shamans in New Guinea and Australia when they don't realize that what they're looking for so far away across oceans is right there in their own backyard and their own teachings. So, yes, the mainstream is hesitant, and I don't get a lot of speaking engagements. But I have to also say that there are some temples, some rabbis who are open-minded enough, even though it's not the way they were taught. When they read my book, Magic of the Ordinary, for example, or Daily Kabbalah, they read all these very strange teachings, but I give the sources so they can look it up themselves. They know how to read Hebrew. And then they invite us to come and share these things because they themselves are fascinated. I get emails, not constantly, but maybe one every 7 or 8 years, of a rabbi asking me for sources for this or that, to tell me more about Judaism's teachings about the goddess tree, because I'm giving a sermon on this, and I heard that you once spoke about it and have sources. So that's really very illuminating, and that this is opening up more and more. And people are getting a little bit more inviting, putting out the welcome mat to learn more about these non-mainstream teachings that were left out of the mainstream for centuries because it wasn't very safe for us to be teaching these things to the masses. It was only in secret Kabbalistic societies. You know, we're living through the Middle Ages and Dark Ages, and we're under the thumb of other cultures for whom any mysticism was punishable by being burnt at the stake. I mean, the church burnt their own people over and over again for dabbling in mysticism. So we were afraid, so we kind of put it underground. And now that there's a lull, and it's against the American law, at least, to burn people at the stake, the Wiccans are coming out of the closet, the Native Americans are coming out of the closet, and they're able to do dances they weren't even able to do in 1970. Mm-hmm. And so we Jewish people are coming out of our closet, too, a different kind of closet.
Let's go back to where we began, Genesis.
Oh, back there again.
Let's interpret that. When you said you rewrote it, you reread it, you'd listen to this show, you'd look at it again, and all of a sudden things seem to pop out at you.
Yes.
What do you think they meant when they said God created everything in 6 days?
What did they mean? Well, it means that God dreamed, that the Creator dreamed, the Creator intended.
One heck of a dream.
Yeah, it is one heck of a dream. Dreams can go any which way. We are part of God's dream. We are a figment of God's imagination. You know, in the reading, the English translations are really sad, very sad. I mean, the original Hebrew was translated into Greek, and then from Greek into Latin, and then from Latin into English by the Flemish. So a lot got lost in the translation, unfortunately. So in the correct reading of the first passage, for example, it doesn't say, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. It says, while beginning the creation of the heavens and the earth being unformed and chaotic, and the Spirit of God hovering over the abyss, and God said, let there be light, and there was light. That's when, you know, that's how you read it. You read it while beginning, because there is no beginning, because God is infinite. So therefore, if everything emanates from what we glibly refer to as God, who we understand as infinite, then there is no such thing as beginning. There is only as in the middle of beginning. And in the middle of beginning, the ineffable, unpeggable, unnameable, ungraspable mystery that we call glibly God created of itself an aspect, an attribute, a quality of itself that is Elohim. Elohim means mastery of all powers and possibility. And Elohim, which is only one aspect of God, created the world. And this is a teaching in the Zohar. It's very radical, and most people I teach it to, they just can't grasp it. You know, they just want to stick with the customary translation. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Right? They're afraid to go any deeper. But the depth of it is beautiful, that there is more to God than what God has chosen to reveal of itself through the venue of creating the universe. And so God is not the creator, and the creator is not God. God is more than the creator. The creator is only one aspect of God that created the world, and that's Elohim. That's the name of that quality that created the universe. So it's a whole different reading of Genesis when you read it that way. And you see the evolution, you see the Big Bang, you see everything that scientists are discovering about the origin of the universe, that little atom or the rock.
The God particle.
Right, the God particle, there you go. That six-year-old George Nouri found years before they found the God particle, and years before Gershon Winkler, the great rabbi, discovered it in the Zohar. You know, because deep inside you, there is this sense that why does God need to create? God, all that God needs to do is think,
and
imagine, and that imagination becomes the myriad possibilities of this of the intent that was encrypted in that very seed of first thought.
And I'm gonna go ahead.
Yeah, and all of this you can see in the very first verse of Genesis, which just says, while beginning the creations of the heavens and the earth, period. That's all you need to know. The rest of it is the commentary, details of how it all began to evolve and unfold through these seven cycles.
Let's talk a little bit about angels in the minutes we have before the top of the hour, then we'll take calls with you next hour. I had a guest on first hour. We talked about what she thought angels might be. What do you think?
Angels are the translators of the dream, the translators of God's dream of creation. In other words, if you, George, you have a thought. That thought, if you were God, that thought would become a living being and translate your thought into realization. And there are different levels of that translation. There are different, it's a spiral of many, many levels of the evolution of that thought, of that dream into its realization. And those are the different levels of angels. One angel gives to the other, to the other. They are weavers. The angels are weavers. They are spirit beings that are weavers, beings created out of the thought and intent and will of the great mystery we refer to as God. And so we have teachings, for example, that even people can create angels. if you do something really fantastically wonderful that comes really from a deep abyss deep inside you, that draws from your soul place, which in turn is drawing from the divine place, and creates an actual angel, an actual being that is the embodiment of your thought, of your intention, and goes out into the world to do good things in the world that are related to that intent that you had. It's an actual teaching we have in the Talmud. And so angels are the translators that weave the intent of God into manifestation, into the garment of whatever it needs to become, whatever needs to happen. So they're messengers in a way too, but more than messengers, they are weavers and translators. So they have the only will, free will that they have, according to our understanding, is the free will to determine how they are going to carry out their mission of weaving and defining and translating the intent of Creator into the realization of creation.
Fascinating. The books that you have, the ones I have with me now, where do you get them?
Where do I get them? Well, I got to go to them from my publisher.
Not you.
I don't know. You get them from a bookstore that has them. Sometimes Barnes & Noble has them. Sometimes you have to just go to Amazon.com, or you can even get them from me sometimes. I have some stock of those books. Yeah, get them from me. You know, get on my website, walkingstick.org.
I wonder if I can get you on Showtime, the comedic rabbi.
I would love to. I sometimes laugh in my sleep, too. I don't know. I can't remember the jokes, though.
Well, let me ask you this before we get to the phone calls next hour. Well, with all that's been going on, with all that's been happening on this planet right now, where do you think we really are? I mean, are we on the threshold of enlightenment, like the Mayans might say? What's happening to us?
We are on the threshold, all right. But the question is the groom going to be there to carry us across it? You know, there, we're on the cusp. I definitely feel we are on a cusp. We are at the edge of something really big. It could be a chasm of a void, of emptiness, of chaos, or it could be a chasm of complete revolutionary renewal, undreamed of by the early masters and early predictions and prophecies. That choice is up to us. So there are some people who are illuminated by the atmosphere and by the energy of our time and feel that something great is going to happen, and they're putting out the welcome mat for it in really good ways. And there are some people who are just totally oblivious and not looking at where we're going, where we're headed with the future shock. You know, that was written decades ago by Alvin Toffler.
Let's ask, where are we going when we come back, and phone calls?